The subcommittee of the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, Representative Patridge and Representative Hansen are excused. Representative Patridge continues to sort issues out with the governor's office and on some budget issues that he's working as he works towards some balancing. And I understand perhaps Senators George and Devlin are on their way as we speak. We're opening a public hearing on the Department of Corrections, Senate Bill 5509, and continuation of yesterday's public hearing. And today we have two items on the agenda, the sentencing laws and the effect of the Department of Corrections with Phil Lehman, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and then the Corrections Programs with Scott Taylor, Assistant Director of Corrections Programs. So let's go ahead. Doug, do you need to make any introductions as we tell what we're going to be doing today and proceed forward?
I don't think so, sir.
All right. Then we'll start with Phil Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Lehman. I'm the Executive Director of the State Criminal Justice Commission. The commission serves as the Sentencing Commission for Oregon, and we establish and administer the state felony sentencing guidelines, and I've been asked to come talk to you briefly about sentencing laws and how they affect correctional populations. And so I prepared a brief handout. I'm going to try to keep this at a pretty high level and go through it fairly quickly. First point is that Oregon has multiple felony sentencing laws. The guidelines deal with the largest number of offenders. About 13,000 people per year receive either a prison or a probation sentence because they are sentenced under sentencing guidelines. The guidelines cover all types of offenses, including drug crimes, property crimes, person crimes, driving crimes, and others. Measure 11 is, I think, the one you hear most about. That covers about 700 people a year as opposed to 13,000 under guidelines. But these people all go to prison, and they receive multi-year sentences. And so they are at the, if you try to identify them on this guidelines chart, if you take the rows 9 through 11, which are the most serious felonies under our classification scheme, those are the crimes that generally are covered by Measure 11. And so the effect is that Measure 11 takes those crimes and establishes a mandatory minimum sentence. So even, for example, if the guideline sentence is 36 months for a Category 9 crime with someone who has no criminal history, that sentence imposed under Measure 11 will be 70 months because Measure 11 sets the mandatory minimum. If, for example, on the other hand, if you go to the other end of the scale and look at 9A, a person who has three or more prior convictions for an assault or other person crimes, the guidelines actually call for a higher sentence than the Measure 11 minimum, and so the judge can impose that guideline sentence above the Measure 11 minimum. Repeat property offenders is the other major statutory law that supersedes the guidelines. About 800 people a year receive prison sentences under this repeat property offenders law, mostly for theft, auto theft, and identity theft. If you're trying to locate those people on the grid, they would be in crime seriousness categories 2 through 4 and grouped in criminal history column E and F. So those are people who have multiple prior convictions for a listed series of property crimes, and rather than the presumptive probation sentences the guidelines establish, the repeat property offenders law establishes presumptive prison sentences for them. Then there are several other laws that affect sentencing. Those include the dangerous offender, gun minimum, Denny Smith, and there are others. That's only about 100 people a year, so they are very narrow and limited to specific circumstances. The other thing you'll be hearing more about is Measure 74 from 1999, which is in the Constitution at Article 1, Section 44, and that limits the ability to modify judicially imposed sentences. So briefly going through how the guidelines work. The Criminal Justice Commission establishes a crime seriousness ranking for each felony crime under Oregon law, and that is the vertical axis on the grid, 1 through 11, 11 being the most serious. We then have 9 categories of criminal history, ranging from no criminal history up to having 3 or more prior convictions for a person felony. The way the guidelines work is they put extra weight in terms of the sentencing scheme for crimes that involve either actual or threats of violence against another person. And so as you look at the crime seriousness rankings, the person crimes such as murder, rape, robbery, assault, all are at the top end of the scale, and then the the sentencing guidelines, as they look at criminal history, put extra weight on people who have a person crime conviction in their criminal history. So that being A through D. So when the person comes before the judge, state law requires that their actual criminal history be identified for the sentencing judge. And so if this person, for example, is an 8D, the judge has a presumptive sentence of 27 or 28 months that should be imposed in the typical case. The guidelines authorize discretion and establish what the borders, the boundaries of that discretion, and so a judge can increase or decrease the sentence severity through a departure process. And in order to do that, the judge has to find that there are substantial and compelling reasons to modify that sentence. And the judge can impose a longer or shorter sentence in the, for example, in this case, a longer prison sentence or a shorter prison sentence, or do what we call a dispositional departure and go from what otherwise would be a prison sentence down to a probation sentence. So the guidelines structure that discretion but do allow for a variety of changes to the sentence depending on the circumstances of the case. There are two general dispositions for sentencing, one being prison, the other being probation. And as you look on the grid, everything that is yellow or orange on this grid is a presumptive prison sentence. And so the typical offender will get a prison sentence if they fall in that grid block. Now, the other thing you'll hear about is Senate Bill 1145, and anything that is a prison sentence but is 12 months or less is served in a local facility rather than a state facility.
So it could be sentenced to prison, but if they had, for instance, a 5D of 9 to 10 months, then that would probably 1145 wouldn't go to
a state
Eastern
prison.
Oregon or
correct.
Snake River.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The other thing that I think is important to note, though, is that the people who are directly sentenced to 1145 are relatively small in number. Most of the people in that population are either on post-prison supervision or on probation and get revoked from one of those statuses or get sanctioned longer than 31 days. And so the vast majority of people in 1145 are people who are on supervision who then get sanctioned.
Mr. Lemon, do I understand that some judges are moving prisoners to 13 to 15 months for some special situations where they just fear that, I guess that would be somewhere in the 6C and D area, where they would make sure that they didn't serve in any kind of a 1145 arrangement?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. As we look at the departure process, for example, anybody who is below the dispositional line, so in the pink, blue, or green areas of the grid, we have rules that say for that person what the maximum departure is. And so if the judge can meet the legal requirements to impose a sentence, so for example, if you're looking at a 5I, so the presumptive sentence there is 60 days in jail and a 2-year probation sentence. If you just go to one step over to the right and you see where it says 12 months, that is the maximum prison sentence that you can impose with a departure. And so let me go up, a little better example perhaps would be a 6I, where the departure would be up to 18 months. So if the judge finds that, for example, a 6I, let's just say it's an assault 3, the judge finds that the substantial and compelling reason is that the level of injury inflicted in this assault was much greater than the average case, the judge can use that finding to go to a prison sentence of up to 18 months. And if that prison sentence that the judge imposes is greater than 12 months, then that person will serve their time at a Department of Corrections facility rather than a local facility.
So the bottom portion on the right-hand side, in the pink, blue, or green, are all in terms of days, not months.
Yes. The numbers that are in the grid boxes there are days. The bottom number is the number of jail days. The top number is the number of non-jail custody units, and that can be treatment, work release, community service, and those are, we have a formula in the guidelines rules that establish a conversion rate for that.
You noticed much how the next generation can talk about this sentencing chart and in terms of crime where maybe some older people can't. Is that a phenomenon that I found just amongst my own children, or is that...
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I find that a lot of the judges, you find that there's a very generational difference in how judges view the guidelines. If judges have been on the bench prior to 89 and they're used to having the authority to sentence anywhere up to the maximum indeterminate sentence that the legislature sets, for example, Class C felony is 5 years, they much prefer that sentence, that sentencing authority and that ability. If judges have kind of grown up in the guideline system, they're at least accustomed to it and not used to having the same latitude and discretion that previous judges had. The reason Oregon went to a guideline system in the late 80s is because we had not built any prison facilities for quite some time, and the parole board was in a requirement to let them out the back door, and there was no truth in sentencing. So
when
did
this begin then?
For felonies committed on or after November of 1989. And so truth in sentencing was a major principle involved in development of the sentencing guidelines. So again, as you look at the grid, the front page lists most of the felony crimes that the legislature has established in Oregon, starting at abandoning a child and through felony wildlife violations. They are color-coded on this grid, so the red print indicates a person crime. And so, again, those are defined by the Criminal Justice Commission. Those are generally ranked higher than most of the other offenses, and they count more severely if you come back into the system and that counts as your previous conviction. We have a property series that, for example, arson, burglary, theft, auto theft, that the sentence severity is based on the amount of damage or property loss involved in the case. The green are drug crimes, and there's a separate formula for that, and then the black is everything else. Then you can see that Measure 11 is set out in the middle of the grid there. Those are the most serious offenses under Oregon law. As you can see, there's a couple Category 8s, but most are 9s and 10s, and then murder is the only Category 11 crime under state law. If you flip to the back page, I would just draw your attention to a couple things there. On the left-hand column in the middle where it says repeat property offenders, that was a statute that was adopted by the 1996 special session of the legislature when they were funding the provisions of Senate Bill 1145. And that was an effort in part to pull some chronic property offenders out of local control, out of the local justice systems, and house them at state facilities. Then many of these other things are kind of details, and I'm not sure you're interested in. The departure factors up in the upper left-hand column of the backside are the factors that we list in rule. So if a judge finds that there was deliberate cruelty involved in the commission of an offense beyond what is in the statute, then the judge can use that to elevate a crime. It's an aggravating factor. If the victim was an aggressor or participant in the criminal conduct, for example, in a bar fight, and this guy picked the fight but ended up losing in terms of who got beat up worse, then the judge can use that as a mitigating factor and reduce the sentence of the person who won the fight or inflicted that damage. Optional probation is just that we have a different set of rules for three grid blocks in Category 8, where if the judge finds that a treatment program is more likely than a prison term to reduce the risk of recidivism and the program is available and the person did not use a gun in the commission of the crime, then there's an easier legal path to impose a probation sentence as opposed to a prison sentence. Determinate sentences at the bottom left is the what we call the Denny Smith Initiative, which was enacted in the mid-90s that prohibited probation sentences for a certain narrow group of repeat offenders. That only affects about 50 people a year now. So that is, as the guidelines and other statutes have developed, the Denny Smith law has kind of faded into significance.
That's for the diminished sentences? Is that for optional probation?
It prohibited probation sentences. So, for example, if you had been convicted of a burglary one, a residential burglary, and you came back and committed another residential burglary, the Denny Smith law at that time would have prohibited that person from getting a probation sentence. It would have required you to go to a state prison facility. And so at the time, and you can see that the presumptive terms there are between 11 and 15 months, so they were fairly short terms. They also covered a series of crimes that are now subject to Measure 11, such as murder, manslaughter, assault, kidnap, and some of those others. So because of the evolution of the other sentencing laws, that's kind of faded into obscurity. Crime categories, we do take some crimes and assign them multiple crime seriousness rankings because the statute itself covers a wide range of conduct. And so that's what that list at the top right corner is. The next color table under property offenses, again, we organize those by the level of damage or loss to the property and have different rules for vehicles and other property crimes. And then the drugs gets fairly complicated, and rather than go into that, I would just say that we divide them into possession in one category and delivery and manufacture in another. And then the crime seriousness rankings are based on the amount of drugs that you have, the type of drugs that you have, whether it's heroin or marijuana, for example, and what kind of activity you were doing, if you were actually selling to make a profit, if you just possessed a large amount, and those are kind of the general breakdowns that we have there. Talked a little bit about Measure 11, and again, those are the basically Category 9 through 11 crimes. It does not operate under a consideration of crime seriousness, or I shouldn't say crime seriousness, of criminal history. So in other words, it has the same mandatory minimum sentence regardless of whether you are a first-time offender or a repeat offender. The legislature in 1999 passed a statute that does allow some what I call departures from the mandatory minimum. So in some cases of assault 2, robbery 2, and kidnap 2, and kind of the lower end of those type of cases, there's a statute that allows a judge, if the person qualifies, gives the judge discretion to impose either a lesser prison sentence or in some circumstances a probation sentence, even though that person is convicted of a Measure 11 crime. Repeat property offenders, I think I've kind of given you an idea of how that works. Again, those are Category 2 through 6 and primarily criminal history E through F. And that's where the concern and complaint was that the guidelines, a person could commit an endless series of property crimes and never get a presumptive prison sentence. So that statute was designed to remedy that and also to help pull some people out of 1145 when that was passed. Just to close, the general formula that I think is helpful to keep in mind is that the impact on correctional populations, whether that's in prison or in the community on supervision, is basically the number of people times the length of stay. And so if you have one prison bed, you can fill that with one person for 12 months or 12 people for 1 month apiece. And so as we have gone through time, the state correctional system has focused more on the longer-term offenders, especially in the case of ballot measure 11. Other things that I think is just important for you as policymakers to know is that the most serious offenders, whether you define those by the crime they commit or by their criminal history, use the most resources in our public safety system. The largest number of offenders are the ones who commit the less serious offenses and have the less serious criminal histories. And that the guidelines were designed in 1989 to allocate correctional resources. And what we have is a system that can be scaled and used to do that, whether it's increasing or decreasing. And I'm sure as you hear more about some of the options to reduce or to match the workload, for example, in community corrections with the available funding, that we've used the guidelines to try to go through that process. Just to briefly show you the other handouts in the packet, the table is basically just a... and this has page 7 on the bottom of my handout here. That just shows you the number of people by grid block. So, for example, there were no persons convicted of murder who in 2001 who had 3 or more prior convictions for a person crime. There were 5 people who had 2 or more, and there were 9 who had no previous criminal history. But as you can see, there were a total of about 14,770 offenders sentenced for a felony in Oregon during 2001. Of those, 4,000 or almost 30% had no prior criminal history. And also, about 4,000 committed a Category 1 offense, with the vast majority of which is drug possession in personal use amounts. And so if you just look at Category 1, 830 of those people committed a drug possession offense and had no prior criminal history. And going over to the left of that row, 112 people were convicted of drug possession as their most serious offense, but had a history of repeat person crimes. So that will just tell you, give you an idea of where people fall on the grid. Category 1 basically is drug offenses. 2 through 5 are all primarily property offenses such as theft, auto theft, identity theft. Category 6 are primarily assault threes and the domestic assaults that the legislature has established. Category 8s, many of those are drug offenses. And then as you can see, the 9s, 10s, and 11s, those are the Measure 11 type crimes, and they are relatively few in number, but obviously they go to prison for long periods of time. I understand you're having a presentation from Sue Porter on the forecast, but I did want to pull out just a few pages from that to give you another way of looking at how the sentencing laws affect the correctional capacity.
I just wanted to ask,
yes,
relative to the seriousness of the crime, all the level one, I noticed that on the level one and the level two, the 90 and the 30, the number of days, total supervised time and jail time is the same. And so as I look at that, the 112 on a level one offense with multiple property or with multiple person crimes, and the level one sentencing guideline I with no prior felonies, would they still be considered for the same number of days?
Yes, sir. The main difference that we would see there is a higher departure rate in those Category 1A people. So I think that, and I haven't looked at these numbers, but I think what you would see, especially in the E's and F's and A's and B's, where you get the repetitive criminal history, is where you're more likely to see departure sentences imposed by judges. And so that's how the guidelines and the players in the system handle those kind of circumstances.
Okay.
The other thing I would point out is that the other substantial difference would be that when that person is placed on supervision, they go through a risk assessment instrument. And so the fact that that person has three prior person crimes on their history means that they will be supervised at a much higher level. The 1A people will be supervised at a much higher level than the people who are in Category 1I.
Do we know of the 4,070 folks that were on that line one, how many of them spent how much time, or is that even tracked?
Yes, we do. Well, let me put it this way. The data that we have, that the Criminal Justice Commission has, is the sentencing data. So as the judge imposes the sentence, that is reported to us, and we can tell you that's how we project the impact of crime-related legislation. The actual time they serve is basically tracked through the Department of Corrections Information System, where the probation officer keeps track of that the person went into jail for 10 days, came back out, went in for 5 days on a sanction, came back out. And so we would get that information there in terms of actual length of stay.
And when we talk about multiple felonies, that can be within any jurisdiction of Oregon and other states, or just Oregon?
Mr. Chair, it's all states, including the federal government, as long as the elements of the crime are lined up with Oregon laws.
Okay, all right.
And I also point out that that we also track juvenile adjudications for what are felonies, and so to the extent those remain on a person's record, those are counted in their criminal history under the guidelines.
And finally, in that regard, when someone begins to matrix in, I guess I can say that with regard to this, when they begin to matrix into the grid, and they matrix in one county in a juvenile program, is the paperwork the same in the county that they matrix in, uniform throughout the entire state in the juvenile system as it is with the correction system when they finally end up heavily into the matrix?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
I'm looking for the forms themselves. Are they uniform forms, or do we have people gathering information and trying to input it into a system each time the person is charged under multiple felonies? Do we have a uniform system of entering that information in the first county and the last county, and is the Department of Corrections data entry sheets, are the data entry sheets that they would use, the same, so that we're not trying to figure out who this person is all over again, or perhaps enter one spelling error in the name and find out that person, as a result of being Jesse in one place and Jesus in another, and Jack and another is really the same person that's been sentenced multiple times for the same issue.
Well, you've covered a lot of territory there. Let me see if I can break it down into pieces and answer your question. Getting the same person the same time is partly an issue of identification. And so to the extent they are fingerprinted, the booking agent can check the fingerprints and see if this person registered as Jesse and shows up in the Oregon State Police.
Talk about fingerprinting for just a moment. Do you immediately, I guess there's a way of coding the fingerprint. Do you immediately codify the fingerprints?
Mr. Chair, you're getting a little outside my area of expertise. That is a state system that they can, I believe that when a person is booked into jail or when they are referred as a juvenile, they are supposed to have their fingerprints taken. That goes to the Oregon State Police repository, and that is a system-wide repository that people can check against. How often that actually happens, and that I think is probably a better question for people who actually work in that system.
I guess at some point we're going to have to ask that because we're still trying to identify the same people. But we now have facial recognition techniques, and as I understand it, that's going to be very precise, much like fingerprinting is going to be precise. My concern is that if there's a series of 200 different identifying factors in a fingerprint, and yet we just pitch those into a file somewhere, the possibility that those may never, ever be checked. I don't know how that's done, but my angst is that that just because we have fingerprints taken on somebody that was involved in a crime in one county, and they happen to have that in their repository, and then someone else fingerprints that person on another aggravated crime in another place, and assuming that their identification is not immediately caught, because as we know, that is a serious issue, and we have bills right now going before the legislature relative to lying to a peace officer as to who you really are. My concern is that if we don't have those identifying characteristics codified somewhere, that the same person might have committed eight different crimes under eight different names, and we'll never matrix into the system when in fact they probably are a bad actor.
My response to that, Mr. Chair, would be that I'm sure we have areas where we do not capture that and still have difficulties in identifying to know that that is the same person that's in Malheur County who previously was in Multnomah County. The extent to which that's an issue, I really couldn't say, but I'll try to get some information to State Police and get that back through Doug.
I guess it's the same issue that we face with regard to having our wells tested. The state law says that whenever you sell a piece of property, you've got to have your well tested. Well, I have my well tested, submit the information to a department somewhere in Portland. They pitch it into a pile, and it never goes anywhere. And I'm saying, that's a $100 test that I have done. I go through this fingerprinting process, and it's all well and good, and it identifies me as to how I've been able to, whose ever identification I was carrying at that particular time. If it doesn't get it entered into a system that says, here's someone with 200 characteristics, and they score this place, and it's my understanding that those characteristics are unique to an individual, even in spite of cloning. But if we don't categorize that, if we don't catalog that information, so that we'll know what those are, and I understand that there is a method of doing that, then it might as well just go into a pile in a box in an office in Portland, and there forever, molder in a pile. And I do have a concern about it.
I think we're ahead of the pile in the box theory, but I'll try to get information from State Police.
Great, glad to hear that. I'd like to know that something is actually being done relative to the codification of those identifying unique features. Please continue.
The last thing I just wanted to point out to you, Mr. Chair and Senator George, is if you go to the pages marked 15 and 17, again, to make the point that the number of offenders times the length of stay is what actually drives the correction impact. So on page 15 is the portion of the corrections population forecast from April of this year that shows the projected Measure 11 population. In January of 2003, it's just over 4,000. By January of 2013, it's over 7,000. And so you can see that even though that's 700 people a year, that population is climbing at a fairly substantial rate. By contrast, if you go to the next page, which is the repeat property offender population forecast, you start that same period of time at about 1,000 offenders, and you end up just shy of 1,400. And so that is a larger number of offenders, but you're driving a much smaller prison capacity because they have shorter lengths of stay, and so it's not compounding like interest would. And so that's briefly what I came to talk to you about the sentencing laws. I'd be glad to answer any other questions you might have.
Director, are there questions for Mr. Lemon, Phil Lemon? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you.
I'm sorry if I got a little anxious about the identifying characteristics, but I would like to know that we're actually that we're moving into the next century with regard to the characterization of this, particularly with regard to now that we're going to have photos that will have identifying facial characteristics, which can create. And we tried to get, incidentally, I worked with Representative Patridge's staff to try and develop a bill that would allow those characterized characters and features. And we've been unable to come up with anything because federal law is moving along on it, but it's still somewhat slow. We'll then go over to Correctional Programs, Scott Taylor, Assistant Director of Correctional Programs. Scott? You need to sign in. Oh, you brought your health away.
Mr. Chair, I'll have a discussion with you about the fingerprinting. And maybe when we work session, if you would like some more information beyond written form, we can get them.
Doug, I really would, because the angst that I have as we move forward in the overall identification process, now that we're going to facial characteristics, and that gives us a whole new database and data bank to work from, and driver's licenses technically should be able to have some of those characteristics for identifying purposes, and as we're moving more in the computer age, that really can give us some good database, much more positive identification factors. Please, Mr. Taylor.
For the record, my name is Scott Taylor, Assistant Director of Correctional Programs with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here today to discuss the program section of the Department of Corrections. The starting on page 20 of our document, corrections programs implementing an evidence-based corrections program services. An evidence-based program provides an opportunity for the department to positively impact inmates while incarcerated and reduce disruptive behavior and additional resources we might dedicate to security. In addition, the same research provides confirmation that involvement in targeted interventions can reduce the future criminal behavior of inmates upon release to the community. The programs division was specifically created to deal with a variety of services and interventions within DOC. And those basically break into two categories, those that are standard operating required, mandated either by federal, state, constitution or law, and then a set of specific interventions that we that address criminal conduct or the criminal to the concurrent crime and or may contribute to future crimes. We've done a variety of searches of the data, as Dr. DeHaan talked about yesterday, and we've tried to target and match those interventions that we apply to people. I'll talk a little bit about that a little later in this. In addition, we provide services such as medical, pharmacy, mental health, and basic education. And those are required. Those are those constitutional or ORS case law type. As Mr. Wilson talked about yesterday, whenever we talk about constitution, the issue that we face is a definitional. We frequently look to case law or some statute that gives us clarity about how far in, how far out when we try to work with some of the population. Effective delivery of these services reduces lawsuits, mental health-related disturbances, and the high costs of off-site medical treatments, increases safety of our institutions, and reduces the likelihood offenders will commit new crimes upon release. We're continuing to work with our research department in developing a more thorough evaluation system that measures and tracks the effectiveness of the programs. Our goal there is to more target, as continue to refine the targeting we do and the impact we're getting from the target so that we're addressing the criminal behavior of individuals and even in some of the other areas that we manage our mental health, medical, those sorts of things in the most cost-effective way we can. Moving to page 21, basically the programs division is made up of the intake and assessment. And I'll talk more in detail about each of these, but that basically is everybody that comes in the Department of Corrections goes to Wilsonville and goes through our intake assessment. That lasts approximately 22 days. Health services. We provide health services to all inmates incarcerated. Because they're incarcerated, there's a variety of constitutional and state statutes that deal with the way we have to treat them and the avoiding cruel and unusual punishment by the way we respond. That usually is matched to the community standard of health care. Mental health, we right now have grown to 21% of the population that comes into the Department of Corrections has a mental health problem. We would gauge 12 to 13% of those are serious, severe. And we are required, again, to deal with those. And it also just makes correctional management sense when we have those folks inside a confined population that we try to manage them as best we can. We have an alcohol and drug. We perform the alcohol and drug services for the department. Roughly 80% of the people coming into the Department of Corrections have an alcohol or drug problem. We would judge that 48% of those are what we would classify as severe alcohol and drug problems.
What percent severe?
I'm sorry, sir?
What percent severe? I'm sorry.
48%.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Pharmacy services to provide both the mental health and the medical. This in this last biennium, we broke out a centralized pharmacy, and that provides all the pharmaceuticals to the Department of Corrections. I'll talk more in depth about the process of that in a moment. Religious services is also part of the programs division. Religious services provides all the spiritual guidance and the faith-based issues within the department. And workforce development includes education, work-based education, and cognitive development classes. And that currently, when folks come into the Department of Corrections, about 52% meet the definition of functionally illiterate. Moving on.
52% functionally illiterate.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman. Moving on to page 25 and 26 are our charts, our organizational charts. Moving on to page 27, talking a little more in depth about each of those services I've just listed. Intake and assessment. The last 3 or 4 months, we've averaged about 400 inmates, 400 or more inmates per month coming into the Department of Corrections. That assessment takes 22 days. As we talked about, this is a place that starts our whole Oregon accountability model and sets up for us a real picture of who we have and what we have, both in all areas, both in physical, mental, past criminal history, and that allows us to then begin to put together a specific plan that we will manage then for the entire time that individual is with us and hopefully out into the community. It becomes part of their parole plan also. We try to identify specific areas that we work with. The recent research and our work with Canada and with some of the analysis that's gone on elsewhere identify us for 7 what we call criminogenic factors, and these are factors that are tied directly to future criminal behavior. We try to identify the needs of the individual or the ranking they have within those 7 areas and then target our intervention to those who have the most severe or highest level need. We then tie that to their criminality. And when we complete the system that we are on the verge of completing, what our intake center will allow us to have is what we will call, in corrections lingo, a reintegration potential, which takes into effect the past criminal history, the criminogenic needs, and the custody levels within the institution. By combining those 3, we get a picture of the future chance that that person will recidivate, and those are the people we would focus most on the highest level. We also know from the research that the way we approach each of these individuals, that we can do, there are certain individuals, if we give them treatment, it is not beneficial. And there are other people that if we give too much treatment to, we are wasting resources. So what we're trying to do is target the specific need and intervention level we need to hit. We keep trying to refine that as we go along. That is why the intake assessment is so critical for us driving the rest of the process. Health Services manages, as I said, all of the inmates that are currently housed. Because they are incarcerated, it changes the status of our need to respond to medical need. They cannot just go somewhere else and get the medical needs met. We have to provide that for them. We think we run one of the best systems in the country when we compare with others. All of our institutions are accredited by the National Commission on Correctional Health Care. We are, we've studied up. We believe we're HIPAA compliant and meet the necessary standards around that with the waivers for HIPAA. We'll continue to work for the next 9-10 months to make sure we meet that. We run a system that since 1989 has really focused on intervention and prevention, trying to deal with people in a more preventive mode as opposed to episodic. We find that that greatly reduces our cost of off-site care. Our biggest costs come when we have to take people out to hospitals, when we have major decay. My doctors would get upset with that language, but what we find is that the average person coming into the Department of Corrections is physically 10 years older than their chronological age, and because of the lifestyle many of them have led, their bodies are in a higher state of deterioration, so that leads us to a higher ratio of expensive medical issues, and the more we can deal with that before they get out of hand, and we try to manage that both by we have four levels we work through in the medical system trying to manage that. Right now, our cost is about $217 a month per inmate, and when you compare the percentage the Department of Corrections spends on medical, we are the third lowest in the nation. We spend about 5% of our budget. The average in the nation is about 10% of the corrections budget is spent on medical. Moving along to counseling and treatment services on page 29. Counseling and treatment services takes care of two areas. The first is mental health treatment. As I talked about earlier, we have a wide range of individuals that come in. We have 12% that we would say are severely mentally ill. They have severe mental illness, diagnosis, and or without treatment are unable to work in the institution at least half time because of the mental illness. And then we have 9% that require a minimal level of service to function within the institution. We find that managing these individuals in the kind of treatment modality we use, we try to mainstream them or keep them in the general population whenever we can. We find that by providing the programs we do, we reduce the disciplinary infractions they have within the institution. We track that. And their ability to then hold employment inside the institution, develop some sort of skill they might be able to use upon release is one of our goals there. We do have a percentage of the population that's developmentally disabled. That's about 3%. And as part of the CTS program, when an individual comes in, we provide basic education on AIDS, HIV, hepatitis C, and then we make available to anybody who requests during their incarceration testing to see if, in fact, they have either HIV or hepatitis C. And then we have a protocol to try to respond to that as we work with that. Moving on to alcohol and drug. Alcohol and drug, as I said earlier, about 80% of our individuals.
Doc, just so members know, there's been a series of legal actions around hepatitis C across the country that have been in the news. I don't know if you want to respond to how you're addressing that or what issues around for DOC.
Chair Patridge, Mr. Wilson, I'm a little, I want to do this carefully. We currently are facing a lawsuit on hepatitis C, and we believe in our work with the Oregon Health Department and the Oregon Health Sciences that the protocol we use in responding to people with tests for hepatitis C meets the necessary standards.
Thank you. That's sufficient.
alcohol and drug treatment. Counseling Treatment Services provides that, and as I said, 80% of the inmates have some need of alcohol and drug treatment. We'd say, again, that 48% of those are what we would put in the severe category. We offer a variety. We try to match, then, the level of alcohol or drug addiction and criminality in our response. Our program at Powder River that there was some discussion of yesterday, for example, those 50 beds, we try to target the people with the highest criminality and the highest addictive personality. Roughly 5% of our population fit in that very high, narrow corner. I do that because I have a grid in my mind up in that corner box. And that population then, we have some impact on their recidivism rate. That's who we try to send there. All of our assessments try to target that, and we move them through residential treatment, day treatment, group treatment, and education. And as we try to manage the effectiveness, right now, in a conversation yesterday with my head of alcohol and drug, I have one of the questions that came up was about the need. Roughly 48% of the offenders, like we said, will have need intensive treatment, and of those, we'll be able to meet 69% of that, or roughly 3,000 of those we actually have the programs under the governor's budget to meet. That leaves us roughly the 31% additional that we won't meet in what we would call the intensive area of alcohol and drug need. Moving on to pharmacy services, we, as I said in this last biennium, broke out pharmacy as a separate entity. We generate about 300,000 prescriptions a year. We are part of a 41-state bulk purchasing program that allows us to buy at a lower rate than we can locally whenever we've checked that out, tested that against others. We continue to manage that. That comes out to about $1.91 a person. And that allows us then to bring all the bulk purchase into our centralized warehouse. We then blister pack it, assign it specifically to the appropriate inmates in the right institutions, and ship out to the different institutions. And we have pharmacists on staff and pharmacy technicians that then take care of all that and manage that. We believe we've been able to reduce costs, and we continue to try to manage that. As you know, with the inflation rates and everything else, this is one of the areas we continue to watch. About 53 to 54% of these pharmaceuticals are for mental health, the other are for medical. Religious services. Under Oregon federal law, all prisoners have a right to practice their religion. We try to provide that, try to do some faith-based interventions. The other thing that fits into the religious services category is we have over 1,200 religious volunteers that work for us, and that provides them for us a tremendous ability not only to bring in additional individuals, but it ties directly to some of the work we try to do with that earlier criminogenic work I talked about, and that many of those volunteers role model the kind of behavior and pro-social behavior that we would like inmates to experience and come into contact with. As you can see, the volunteers contribute about 192,000 hours of service each biennium. Workforce development on page 32 includes our education and training. As I said, over 52% of inmates at intake lack functional literacy, and they lack the ability to read, write, speak English, compute, solve problems at a level of proficiency necessary to function on the job. And we have several standards we use. Again, coming into intake, there's basic tests we use to establish different levels of reading and writing literacy, math literacy, and we move people through that program. We have a part of the what we have to manage there in our Oregon accountability model. What we've done in the last biennium, again, to try to be more effective and targeted, is we now place are educational services in about four institutions. Individuals who come in and test need education, we move to those institutions where we try to then manage the education needs all the way from English as a second language up through ABE and then into the GED. All of our education services are contracted with the community colleges of Oregon, so that's who actually provides that through contract. And the same with, I should have mentioned earlier when we talked about the alcohol and drug and some of the mental health, we do a lot of contract locally for that as opposed to direct correctional staff. We also do some work-based education. We've really been trying to target that over the last year, narrowing that down. We try to do market studies. We try to provide this kind of skills that people might be able to use upon release. We continue to allow or do less and less of that and target the kinds of work we do for true employment immediately walking out. We do find that a large percentage of people that go through a couple of our programs find employment upon release. And last is cognitive behavioral programs. Cognitive behavioral programs are critical to address several of those criminogenic needs. And a lot of the research indicates that the cognitive behavioral programs, while one of the least expensive, gives you some of the highest return on investment in both the long term. It's one of the few treatments that continues to grow as time goes on and expand its impact. And so we have several contracts where people will come in, provide some high-level cognitive training. We're trying to modify some of the programs to more and more specifically deal with criminal thinking errors along with basic community interaction. Next is transitional services. Transitional services is a project we started a couple years ago. Actually, we've been doing it ever since there's been prisons, but we've tried to focus on that. We are now the national model for the National Institute of Corrections has adopted the program we use because it talks about the entire time from the moment an individual enters the system, we start working on transition with a focus, as was talked about yesterday, since 94 to 95% of the people will return to the community. We start trying to do the planning about what does that mean? What changes have to take place and what kind of planning right when we get down to the last few months even of where we live, where we stay, what kind of budget management, all sorts of things go on within that. It engages a whole group of community partners. The transition committee we use has about 30 different organizations that participate with the Department of Corrections on that. We've partnered well with DHS, Department of Housing, Mexican consulate, to name a few of the participants that join us in that work. And the costs, administrative costs, is on page 35 with the ratios. I think most of those fit within an acceptable range. Would like to point out again that both the workforce development and mental health do a lot of contracting. The interagency governmental programs, a great deal of what we do matches up with community partners who do the same kind of work. So our intake assessment, we work with the courts and with the law enforcement, all that sort of stuff to get the records. As was mentioned earlier, our computer system that we use within the Department of Corrections is also used by probation parole officers, so we have a good database. We try to use that for the intake, match up that whenever possible. Health services, we try to work with the health department, with the OHSU, other folks, make sure that we're on track with that. Several of our folks have been active in national health organizations. Counseling and treatment services, we've been doing some special projects. We were doing some work with particularly our mentally ill. We targeted a group of people that we thought were our most volatile. And we had worked with the Oregon Health Plan to make sure that upon release, their medication and the other things were continued so there was no lapse in service and they had wraparound for housing, those sorts of things upon release. We hope to meet with them at the as we move into the next biennium and see what services are still available, how we coordinate that, and where we work. We know that for some of those folks, that kind of response actually is the very thing that keeps them from coming back to us, and we think we can reduce some of those costs. Alcohol and drug treatment, they're all licensed by the Department of Human Services, and we were doing some research. We have quite a few research projects around our alcohol and drug. Dr. Field, who heads up our mental health, alcohol and drug, is a national expert on protocol and the setting up of those programs. Religious services, because of the work we do, we interact with a lot of the community-based programs, faith-based. We are reaching out more and more to that. As people release the community, we find that to be one of the strongest stabilizers. And workforce development, you can see we work with the housing. We look with community colleges in the way we try to deal and with them and the interactions we have. I think, Lynn, the cost control measures, I would just, rather than going through all of them, I would just like to say that we think we continually look at the idea of accountability, and we continually try to hone down how we do it, what we target. Everything we try to do is a targeted intervention. I think the cost savings we bring from some of our larger cost items, an example would be in health services, we finally reached a break point where it was cost effective for us to establish a dialysis unit inside. And so once we reached that point, then we moved to that. That has saved us a considerable amount of money in this biennium, and we would expect more in the next biennium as our population ages and continues to grow. Another piece that we continue to manage is that as our female population continues to grow and as the Oregon Health Plan modifies, we find that we're receiving a spike right now in individuals with mental health issues, and our female inmates have a higher percentage of both medical and mental health needs. So we keep trying to manage that and stay targeted on that as we work through that. I talked about the pharmacy and our work through some of the other areas in contract management. I think that Linda talked about I'm all the way now to page 44, and I think Linda talked about the packages yesterday. If I move on to page 48, our budget notes, we were asked to describe what we knew about the effectiveness of our programs, of learning from others, and to that end, we've partnered with the Canadian Federal Prison System, and they just finished coming down here again, training our individuals and working with us around research-based and how to target what we do. They're also learning from us. They're very excited about a mutual. They love research. They love some of our data. We evaluated all of our programs against industry benchmarks and systems. We've used what's called a correctional program assessment inventory. We've run all the programs that we have in the programs division through that. They score very high. We've matched that up to the research as far as what it takes to actually deliver the programs that you say you have. And we believe that we're on track with that. We continue to try to manage to that. And the accountability model brings together and focuses those different efforts. And
if we stop there for a quick second, I'm interested, and I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but, you know, the co-chairs in their budget took a proposed deduction of $7 million in correctional programs, and obviously that would fall within the scope of where we're at right now. I don't know if you're prepared to deal with that today or maybe at the end of when we have the hearings, but I'd like to know what it looks like at $7 million, what your corrections program would look like with a $7 million reduction.
Mr. Chairman, I can give you some idea of what kind of changes. Probably the largest impact would be on the workforce development area and the educational piece within the programs division. They've taken some money out of there. Roughly, I think it's $4.6 million came out of that particular
budget. What's
that? I think it was about $4.6 million came out of the educational work base area.
Okay.
And they've taken some money out of alcohol and drug, some money out of religion. They're still operating programs there, still the ability to deliver services. It does impact us. And then the other, I guess, large area that is the position startup, and that was some of the new positions for the increased numbers. We can probably adjust to that. But each time we do that, what we tend to do then is reduce the targeting that I talked about and the number and the kind of people we address with some of those issues, and we shrink that down, affecting fewer and fewer within that as we try to target it down. Those are the main impacts below that level.
I think part of what they're interested in, too, is at what level of cuts do we exceed what our not necessarily the efficacy of having programs, but the constitutional requirements within the scope of the constitutional and statutory requirements within the scope of what we're faced with in the budget.
Chairman, the cuts that they have delineated there, for the most part, do not drop below the constitutional and statutory requirements. They do affect the alcohol and drug that we've talked about and the efficiency effectiveness, but if the question is strictly constitutional, statutory, and where those lines are, most of those are manageable and keep us still above that line. The only one that there is some question about, as I work through it, would be the workforce development, and that is because of the statute for 421.084 in the definition of functional literacy. There's two kinds of definitions, so depending on the definition there.
Can you delineate what the difference is between the two for us?
One talks about, one section talks about a basis score. Everybody that is tested on a score, an educational score, a basis score, and it cites specifically a score below 230 in reading or math is functionally illiterate. Later on in another section, it talks about the higher standard that seems to match some of the business journals and some of the educational journals. It talks about the ability to function in a community independently. And so that's the ability to hold a job, the ability to do computer work, the ability to that kind of stuff. So,
okay. How do we compare with the program services that we provide versus other similar size institutional systems? Do you have an idea? And then how do we compare kind of on a per inmate basis versus as well as how do we compare with the recidivism rate?
Mr. Chairman, I would be making some guesses and some assumptions about how we compare with other programs in the nation from conversations and interaction with other assistant directors. We always have an apple, oranges, what do you include, what do you don't include, how does it go? I would say that the programs divisions in around the nation go from next to no programs up to some fairly involved, sophisticated.
So there are some federal departments who try and provide some nationalized kind of standards upon which reporting is done.
Other than the things that we're required to do for federal funding and those sorts of things, I am not familiar with some
don't
of those.
Don't those provide some kind of baseline? Ben, do you know?
Not that I.
So there's no national comparisons?
There are, you know, there are compendiums that we use to try and match specific issues. And
but can't you say overall we spend X on our program? You probably can't.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan, the interim director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. Cross-state comparisons are very, very difficult to make. I think the point was clearly made by Dr. Tessa when he was here, because most of the claims the research shows us are unfounded. And so when you claim to have an effective program, it's really difficult to demonstrate that empirically. So when you ask other departments of corrections exactly what they do, it's really a mixed bag. It's hard to know. So you can't really compare across jurisdictions easily.
Compare dollars?
Well, it all depends on what you consider to be a program. For example, in the last legislative session, we had a lot of discussion about what programs were. Activities are often included in that. Everything from vocational skills to deep dish mental health programs and medical. It's very, very difficult to sort out. For example, if another state were to ask us about our program budget, we would include the largest chunk would be medical, and lots of other states don't include that. We can, if you would like us to do so, we can poke around a little bit and see if we can get our best estimate to give you some comparisons, and we can qualify what we find and tell you what we learn. That would probably be the best way to look at it.
Well, let's just hold off at this point. I don't want to send you down the rabbit hole. Something if we can't get any data, it's even reasonable to look at.
I haven't seen it in my look at it anyway.
All right,
and I believe that concludes.
All right. Well, this is an area we're going to have to look at. So if you can give us some more specifics as to how you would rearrange your programs based upon the alleged or proposed $7 million cuts for program, we can continue to talk about that some more as to that specific piece, as well as see if there are other areas or how the department wants to handle global kind of cut piece. Okay? Great.
Chair, we were supposed to sort of have correctional programs all day. You said Mitch is headed down to start with institutions.
I called in about 10 minutes ago and asked him to be here in 10 minutes, so he should be here anyway.
We're running way ahead of schedule.
Well, this is the Express Committee.
Doing
all right. See what happens when the chairman's not here most of the time? He just cruise right through it. All right, well, we'll recess for... We'll just stand at ease for 10 minutes or 5 minutes until he gets here.
we're going to reconvene the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means. We're going to continue on with the Department of Corrections budget. And welcome, Mitch. We appreciate you hustling over here.
Yes, sir. Thank you. For the record, my name is Mitch Morrow, Assistant Director of Institutions Division with the Department of Corrections. And I'm just going to do a program overview of the Institutions Division. The Institutions Division is responsible for the security and housing of Oregon's incarcerated adult felony offenders sentenced to prison terms exceeding 1 year and juveniles sentenced under Measure 11 or who are remanded to adult court. The Institution Division operates under an assistant director, which is myself, and an institutions administrator. And we manage the following programs and services, and they're listed there. If you want me to go through those, Mr. Chair, I will.
We're perfectly capable.
All right. So moving to page...
Well, I don't know perfectly, but we're somewhat capable.
Moving to page 62. The mission of the Institutions Division is twofold, to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable and to reduce the risk of future criminal behavior. And as the director pointed out, I believe it was yesterday, that it's more than just incarcerating inmates. We play a role in preparing these folks for their return to the communities, seeing as that 94% of them someday will be getting out. So we consider that an important part of our job in the Institutions Division. Our goals are to operate institutions that will be safe, secure, civil, and productive for staff and inmates and the public, ensure our employees are active and visible, and that they're skilled participants achieving the mission of the department, ensure that our institutions support and participate in the Oregon accountability model, and be cost-effective through the use of inmate labor, automation, new technologies, minimum staffing standards, and other strategies to achieve economies and efficiencies. Moving to statutory authority, they're listed there. And again, Mr. Chair, if you want me to go through that, I will. If not, I'll keep moving right along.
Proceed.
Following that is the organizational charts on pages 63 and 64. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
You're providing us more detailed org charts and things on a per institutional basis, so we can take a look at those.
Okay. Page 65. The Institutions Division is responsible for the administration of 12 institutions, and our medium and maximum custody facilities are listed in the top listing, two of them in Salem and the other four across the state. And our minimum custody facilities, again, two of them in Salem and the other four across the state. Moving to inmate challenges in 0305, the department faces major inmate management challenges in the next biennium. The April 2003 prison population forecast is, as I know you've been told already, predicting an increase of 1,079 inmates. As of April 1, 2003, 69% of our inmates in our institutions were person-to-person offenders who have committed violent crimes. 1,219 of the inmates are associates or members of gangs or anarchist groups, and 644 inmates are serving prison sentences of death, life, and life without parole. And all of those populations are obviously very difficult to manage and people we pay very close attention to. Page 66. To manage our institution safely, the department monitors critical indicators such as inmate-to-inmate assaults, inmate-to-staff assaults, use of force situations, and major misconduct reports. And the chart there shows you the numbers that we've been dealing with since 2001 and the early months of 2003. The department will be housing up to 977 inmates in temporary and emergency beds within the existing state correctional facilities and up to 200 rental beds in local correctional facilities around the state. The department will be crowding existing correctional facilities without an increase in capacity of special purpose beds. And specifically, that deals with our disciplinary segregation beds. We're at 95, 96% capacity now. And when we go to move these inmates into our institutions, our segregation beds play a critical role in helping us manage those populations. And so...
What's the optimal populations that you guys want to keep, your 95, 94, 90%?
As far as disciplinary segregation, Mr. Chair?
Well, just in terms of the institutions and your ability to manage really you have a variety of management techniques as well as just the beds.
Mr. Chair, I would respond to that by saying that if we at any given time we can keep a 3% buffer between beds that are actually in use and beds that we can, as inmates, and I'm referring to the special housing, inmates that in fact come out of special housing, if we have a 3% buffer of beds in our general population, I don't know if I'm answering your question or not, but...
Yeah, I'm just asking for your occupancy.
Okay.
I mean, in my business, 97% occupancy, 100% occupancy is great, so, but in yours it's a little
It's not,
great.
No. It makes it very difficult to manage.
I'm in the senior housing market, which is a little different.
Use of temporary and emergency beds will tax the department's security and operating systems, including classification transfer, our physical plants, food services, law library access, inmate work, programming, and transitional planning services. The expansion of emergency beds in the older institutions will continue to tax our aging infrastructure. We have some significant deferred maintenance issues in those older facilities, and so obviously by placing more inmates in those facilities, we continue to tax the institutions. As far as the Oregon accountability model, the institutions do play a major role in that model. By ensuring security practices such as custody classification, security threat group management, institutional housing assignments, hold inmates accountable for their actions. And we encourage our staff to influence inmate behavior positively, acknowledge positive change, provide incentives to inmates to change their behavior. And my understanding is that upon release, with post-relief interviews, we discovered that inmates that have left our institutions and moved into the communities, that the people that had probably the most significant influence on these folks was the correctional officers and work crew supervisors. And so we think that's important that we continue with that, and that we do play a role again in that Oregon accountability model and the success of these inmates that are leaving our facilities. We want to provide meaningful work to most inmates while incarcerated, teach the work ethic and give them on-the-job experience as part of the preparation for reentry. Provide programs and services during incarceration to mitigate the inmates' criminal risk factors, and enhance release and transition planning to improve the reentry of offenders back into their communities. Moving on to factors affecting services, there are several major factors that affect, that impact the delivery of services in the correction system. Again, the April 2003 prison population forecast will impact our prison population management plan. Due to revenue shortfalls, the department has suspended construction of new correctional facilities, and we're going to be relying on temporary and emergency beds and local rental beds to manage our prison population growth. And then new crime legislation. As changes in criminal justice policy are enacted through this session, there may be an impact on the department depending on what that legislation is.
I don't think much is moving, but that's all right.
Division administrative costs. There are a total of 3,165 positions in the institution division, 12 of those positions in central administration. And in the 0305 biennium, we reduced central administration positions by 3. It was 15 in the 0103 biennium. And I believe Ms. Acuff will be talking about the specific budget numbers during her presentation. So I will move to interagency and intergovernmental programs on page 68. The department works closely with federal, state, and local governments in meeting the mandates of Measure 17. Work includes forest restoration, and effective this Friday, we have 105 inmates going to the Deschutes National Forest to begin that forest restoration project. That's an annual thing that we do. Firefighting, projects for Motor Vehicles Division, Oregon Department of Transportation, State Parks, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and community service projects for local governments. The department works closely with the Oregon Youth Authority to manage youthful offenders who are sentenced as adults under Measure 11 or who are remanded to adult court. The department purchases food products for OIA facilities located in the Salem area. It's my understanding by talking to these folks, we're working and talking with OIA to expand that as far as purchasing products for their other facilities as well. The department participates in the Northwest Shuttle System with 13 other states to manage the extradition of offenders between states. And last biennium, there was 480 extraditions using this particular system and Northwest Shuttle Systems. If we do it with the Northwest Shuttle System, costs us about $300 an inmate. If we don't use the Northwest Shuttle System, it's about $2,500 an inmate. So it's a significant cost savings by working with it.
I think there were more last year. I mean, we just saw figures in general government because we had the arrest and return stuff. So, but anyway, we can keep going.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The department works closely with INS to ensure that all INS releases are transferred to a central location, and that location is in the Dalles. It's Wasco County Jail. It's referred to as the NORCOR system, and we had 307 INS inmates that we sent there in the last 12 months. Cost control measures. The department has reduced food costs by a little over $4.5 million, from $2.80 a day to $2.30 per day per inmate. In the 0103 biennium, as a result of seasonal menus, volume buying, and most of that savings came from bulk purchases on the spot food market. And I think the director, again, gave you an example. If somebody overbuys French fries and they got a train load left, we'll buy the train car and bring it to our state. And I guess the philosophy there, when I started with the department a while back, our menus used to drive our purchases. But today I would tell you that our purchases drive our menus. So we feed them what we're able to purchase. The department has developed minimum staffing standards for all state correctional facilities. Standards are based on the minimum staff required to manage the inmate population safely and securely. The department uses an institution staff deployment system to manage the deployment of staff in our institutions. And the department has reduced in-state travel, purchased safety equipment using savings from reduced time loss claims, repaired work boots, clothing, and mattresses, increased recycling, reduced the size and number of tactical teams, which is our emergency response, specially trained teams, and implemented a variety of energy conservation measures. Moving to detailed program discussion, once again, the major factor that drives the prison population management plan is the Oregon population forecast. The April 03 prison population forecast is projecting an increase of 1,079 inmates this next biennium, and will move from 11,009 approximately to over 13,000 by the end of July 05. And the 03-05 biennium governor's budget does include funding and staffing required for the continued operation of all our existing institutions. Page 70. The 03-05 governor's budget requests funding to occupy and operate the following constructed capacity, which totals 472 beds, and those are listed there. And then the emergency beds, which is the second list of 441 beds. If there's any questions about that, I'd be happy to answer.
Can you tell the committee, or maybe you can provide us, I know that some of these sites that we've already built at also have footprints available, do they not, for expansion? And I'd be interested in what footprints are available for expansion at the existing sites. If we're going to, and I guess my concern, I'm happy to look at the Lakeview issue, but if we're going to capitalize our debt service on this kind of stuff, I want to make sure we're getting the biggest bang for our buck rather than putting a prison somewhere in the state that we have some substantial costs to transport and maintain.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure we can provide you that information.
So I would be interested in that, Ben, as to the status of whether, I mean, because that stuff's already cited. I don't know if architectural stuff has been drawn on any of that, but we can talk about that later, but I'm interested in that. Okay, let's handle that during construction. Senator Devlin.
Chairman, just to mention, as a veteran of prison siting issues, there are no additional sites available in the Salem area. You do not want to open that issue.
But there are at some of these other.
There are
some of these other ones. I'm sure that there's some at a location near you. Senator Devlin.
No, if the president's watching, there are no additional locations
all
in
right.
Salem.
Well,
Senator George.
I have one in Marion County, but I'm not going to go there either. They're going to get a jail and beat on me on that. Similar to your question, and that is, many times there's an efficiency of the size of the institution. These appear to be relatively small when we look at, 100, that sort of things. How does that compare with, say, six Western states relative to the size of their average prison?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would, as you look at, are you talking about the constructed capacity listing specifically? Powder River and South Fork. Powder River's located right in the middle of the community in Baker, and so there's not a lot of room for expansion. So we built within the perimeter and use whatever space is available there.
No, the main thing I was saying is there an efficiency in the size of it? In other words, would it be better off to have a one facility with 500 beds?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it depends on the type of inmate you're dealing with.
Do we want to do this on the construction piece, Ben? Senator George, why don't we deal with kind of the optimization stuff on the construction issues, and that way Ben and those guys can prep something up for us. So we're interested in what's the right sizing of prisons for maximum cost benefit analysis. Okay.
Continuing on page 70. Governor's budget funds local rental beds to manage the prison population growth for the remainder of the 03-05 biennium. 50 rental beds are funded in May of 05, and another 50 rental beds are funded in June of 05. However, the department has identified the adjustments in the 03-05 biennium prison population management plan that will be needed to reflect increased prison population growth. So the department will need to accelerate the occupancy of our emergency beds and the new prison beds at Coffee Creek and at Snake River Correctional Institution. In addition, the department will need an additional 100 local rental beds by the end of 03-05. So 200 rental beds as a total by the end of 03-05.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin.
What they've done in structuring this budget is obviously giving you the least cost of those rental beds possible, putting them in the last 2 months of the biennium. When do you think, if you have 200, when do you think you're going to start needing the additional capacity?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we, according to the prison population forecast, I'm sure Sue can jump in here if I'm not saying this right, we'll need the first ones in January of 05. And then 50 more March of 05, 50 more in April of 05, and 50 more in May of 05.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if you go back to my presentation yesterday, there's actually a table in there. I think that sort of outlines that for the back. It's attached to the 10 in the far right column to give you sort of an idea when when some of those come on. And I'm sure Sue will go over in more detail than I did.
What's the scope look like for the rental beds that are available to the Department of Corrections? I mean, how much capacity is there with the local communities out there, which is where the rental beds are coming in?
Mr. Chair, I get part of the answer to that question. There's 8 counties that have contacted us and said that they're interested in renting us beds. I don't know the capacity that's available out there in those 400 beds.
Well, there's a capacity of about 400 beds out there.
Mr. Chair, a number of members have asked questions about making sure that we're fully utilizing the resources we have, and I asked a question a month or so ago, and by the time you get done using all these emergency beds, almost every cell in the system that can be will be double bunked. There's a couple cell blocks at the state penitentiary is where you can't, because of the construction of the building and the safety issues and construction issues, you can't double bunk them. But almost everywhere else in the system other than their special management units will be double bunked.
Okay, that's correct.
Senator Devlin.
Would it be fair to say that these estimates of population growth are still based on the counties to this date that are keeping their 1145 inmates, keeping them, and if we have more counties check out of the system, basically we're going to need greater capacity?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a fair assumption.
I also have an issue with the double bunking and the issues surrounding what's going to happen with using the emergency beds in the existing facilities. What kind of, I'd call it an officer safety issue or corrections person safety issue do we have when we do this, and what kind of management challenges do you have in terms of maintaining the system?
Mr. Chair, we looked at that very, very carefully when we selected the 441 emergency beds, and I believe we can do it safely. We left, as Mr. Wilson's pointed out, we left some single bed capacity, very little, but left single bed capacity where we thought we might need it to manage some more difficult inmates. But before I presented the 441 to the director, we looked at it very carefully to make sure that we believed that we could manage those
emergency beds. Are we right up on the edge?
I would say we're right up on the edge.
And maybe over, depending on how the judgment calls me.
Well, we're right there.
Okay.
We're right there. I went through some of this in my early years at the penitentiary, and we're doing things a little bit differently now, and I think what we're doing now is a safer model. We've looked at it again very carefully, and I think we'll be fine. I would not have recommended to the director to go to that point if I didn't think we could do it.
Ben, can we also address during the construction time kind of the optimization of the actual construction I mean, I know that you need a lot less staff to manage the newer institutions because of their design, I think. At least that's my understanding to some degree. Can we talk about overcrowding staffing versus actually building beds and what the staffing models look like? Because, I mean, there's optimization points for safety. There's optimization points for staffing. So I'm trying to kind of get a handle on where we need to go and how we're going to handle the future capacity issues. Okay.
We'll provide that to you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
I'm on page 71 under the performance measures piece. One of our measurements is class one assaults on staff.
Can you define what you mean by a class one assault, since that's not a statutory definition?
Typically, Mr. Chair, that would be the assaults that refer to the state police. It'd be body fluids, physical assault, where there's injury involved on our employees.
So is a class one a misdemeanor assault?
It's a felony. There was actually legislation introduced last session that made class one assaultive activity a felony.
Okay.
And the second measure that we're looking at is the number of walkaways from minimum custody institutions and outside work crews. I'm going to move now to page 77. Ms. Acuff, I believe, is going to go over the packages and the base budget information at a later time. And budget notes and audits. The Department of Corrections was directed to finalize staffing standards for all medium and maximum custody facilities. We took it a step further and also reviewed minimum custody facilities as well. We've completed the staffing standards. However, we haven't quite completed the reallocation of the staff that were impacted by that process, and we will have that done by July of this year. Second.
Coming back, let's stop there for a second. So you've done the staffing study, but you haven't reallocated the staff?
The former director, and I'm sure Mr. Donald, correct me if I'm wrong, the former director said if there's any impact to staff, we would do it by attrition. And we have staff that are impacted by this process. Secondarily, we have some reclass situations. An example would be we had lieutenants in our control centers at Two Rivers. We have downclassed those to sergeants. And so the reclass will be effective by July.
Why are we waiting till July?
Basically because it's an impact to our employees.
For the record, I'm Ben Jehan, the interim director of the Department of Corrections. One of the things that that we probably should say here is that it's true that it took a while to figure out what the minimal level of staffing is, but the number of folks who get redistributed, so to speak, is relatively small.
That's correct.
I think, how many did you decide you had to actually move?
There will be five that actually have to be redistributed.
So another way, Mr. Chair, of looking at that is that the way that the staff are allocated, it's almost completely in conformance with where they ought to be because we've been doing it slowly over time. What we tried to do is to minimize the impact on staff. If you have a position out in Snake River, for example, and they were needed at EO, if we could manage it through attrition, that would be the best thing.
and it looked as if we were going to get there, and the number of staff that needed to be moved was relatively small. Of course, we could speed that up, but it would require laying people off out in some of the rural areas and then rehiring them someplace else.
How long have we been relying on the attrition piece?
I want to say about a year off the top of my head.
That's pretty
close. Is that
about
when it was finished? Mm-hmm. Something like that. So our goal...
An 18-month process to kind of bright size.
We expect what we were shooting for, is, Mr. Chair, is to have it done by the end of the biennium.
Okay. I just needed to know. Thanks.
Question?
Yeah, oh. Question. Wait. Oh. Senator
Jordan. For example, Yamhill County has a relatively high level of automation within the jail system, the jail facility, which requires a relatively minimal amount of staff. If you were to rate as the top automated system as 100%, where would you rate us as far as, I've heard some indication that there's, that we actually are not a fully, not a highly automated handling system.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, are you referring to the mechanical operation of doors and things like that?
The number of people in contact with the prisoners, how they're managed. And, I'm just looking at some of the other numbers up here as far as assault on officers and stuff. I wonder how we compared with, say, the most modern facility. I know some of ours are brand new. Are we designing for that minimum contact level?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, there's a lot of variation in the prisons, obviously. We've got brand new ones, and we've got some that were territorial prisons that existed actually before Oregon was a state. We have, in some of our earlier designs, Snake River, for example, to tell you the truth, I think we may have gone a little too far in overestimating the value of technology. In the bottom line, and there are people in this room who know much more about this than I do, if they're having people out interacting with the inmates is a very, very important thing. And there, we can become more efficient, but there's a point where the technology, the promise of technology, is actually counterproductive. And we've tried to strike that balance, but it's a difficult balance to strike.
Very good.
Yeah, that's what made me question that, is a comment that the interaction between the inmates and the staff, you can pick up that there's a positive impact on release, their attitude towards what they're going to be like when they get into public life.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's absolutely correct. And some people here would be familiar with the operation of some of the larger prisons in California, for example, where they rely on technology and physical barriers. What that causes you to do is to buy more technology and more physical barriers, because they're controlled in a very different way than we control inmate populations here in this state.
That was a comparison I was thinking about, was California. So, but your analysis is that's not a good way to go.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Senator Devlin. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the sake of clarity here, I'm thinking so that in your older institutions, the ones with the larger units or larger cell blocks, it would still be relatively normal on a shift to, if it's a very active shift, to maybe have two staff on duty in that cell block or that unit, and maybe on a fairly inactive shift, one staff member on that, with maybe 180 or 200 inmates in the cell block.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I'm not sure if you were asking for confirmation or...
Yeah,
this guy grew up in the state penitentiary working in
those kinds of...
he should be the one to respond to that.
But I mean, just so that the committee realizes that that's what the staffing level is like inside some of the larger, older institutions.
Mr. Chair, Senator, at the penitentiary, which is probably the best or worst example, depending on how you look at it, if you were to go into E-Block on Graveyard where there's 560 inmates, there's one staff member in there. I don't think you'll find that to be the case on day shift and swing shift, but definitely on Graveyard. And there are obviously some risks associated with that, because people think, the inmates are in bed all night long, when in fact you're kicking people out at 2:30 and 3 o'clock in the morning to go prepare the breakfast meal. So you have movement in your institution with one staff member in that size of a house again, where our newly constructed facilities don't do that. The other piece I want to put out to the committee is as you go into our older facilities, it's a linear model, so you stand on the end of the tier and you look down a tier, so you can't see into the cells. Our newer models are for direct supervision, so if you're standing on the tier, you can actually see the cells in front of you. So that's a change in our design that has definitely enhanced security, but did take away from the interaction between the staff and the inmates. So,
thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, why don't you proceed with the next budget note, then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Second budget note is criminal prosecution of inmates. We worked with three different counties. The state police asked me and the AOCE to review processes and procedures for reporting and investigating and referring for prosecution incidents that occur in our correctional facilities. Dale Penn, Marion County District Attorney, chaired the group. The principle that guided the work group was to determine the most efficient use of available resources. The group recommended maximum use of administrative sanctions and process to provide additional deterrence without additional cost. And the department will explore several suggestions that the work group presented to us. Use of video conferencing equipment to facilitate defense attorney visitation. Identify inmates that are facing criminal charges so that we don't transfer them to another institution across the state and have to bring them back to complete whatever process they're going through in the court system. Determine whether there are other administrative sanctions that we can use that still take care of the due process and constitutional issues, but that we can employ within our institutions, and then determine if there's other investigative options. Right now, if you find a weapon, for example, it's an automatic call to the state police. Is there another way to do that and still protect the integrity of the legal requirements when you find a weapon in an institution? So this work group, in review of a document that I received yesterday, there's going to be some additional work done on this, and the department's going to formulate a group to move these recommendations forward. With that, Mr. Chair, committee, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, too, if anything, or what you've done on maximizing your staffing, how you run your shifts? Is there any opportunities or options there? Have you exhausted those out?
Mr. Chair, the staffing standards, and I did not participate in the process, but I believe the staffing standard process looked at our staffing, and they used some guiding principles, control points, master control, general housing, and they walked through a whole list of things that they would consider that would be needed to manage your institution safely and securely. And then the results of that is what we have as far as the five positions that were left over and a redistribution and down class. But I would say that we're there. I would say that with that process, we have a pretty clear understanding that what we have as far as staff are our minimal levels.
And have you looked at like 8, 10s, 12-hour shifts and how that affects your overtime, if there's some optimization that can occur as a result of any of those kinds of staffing changes that you've worked with your employee groups with?
Mr. Chair, we have a pilot program going on in our intensive management unit, actually, that employs a 12-hour shift. Personally, I'm not too supportive of that. I worked in a segregation unit as a sergeant, a lieutenant, and spending 12 hours a day in that kind of environment, it's a very negative environment. I don't know if that's best for our employees or best for the institution, but there are different models that we're using and looking at right now, and that being one of them.
Mr. Chair, the other thing that I think that responds directly to your question is that we have been working with organized labor to talk about how some of these positions are distributed. We have some agreement, but there's still some areas where we disagree over the number of managers in certain locations. We've been working that process pretty hard for the last two or three weeks. I think we've identified 23 individual positions that can move from management service into represented service, and there are some other efficiencies. But we're talking about, I think, at this point, fine-tuning. I don't know that we'll ever get 100% agreement in the union discussions, but I think we're getting a lot closer than we have been in the past.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to sitting down with both sides when both of you are ready to proceed, or if we reach a impasse, to sit down with both sides to see where we're at on those issues. But I would be interested. I'd like to look at what your staffing is and what your overtime looks like for institutional pieces, so we can at least take a look at seeing where we're at and what we look at. I think that those are very substantial cost drivers, and looking at those issues. So, you know, I sometimes it's better to hire more permanent staff than it is to do the overtime staffing or change shifts, shift referentials. So I'd just like to talk a little bit about that. And that's maybe a more detailed offline discussion to have.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask you how you envision bringing these issues back. We can fit most of your questions in according to the schedule, but some of these other ones, do you want to just finish up after all of the
presentations? We can finish up afterwards. We will have okay. time to explore some of these issues, so you can put some thought, so we can all put some thought to what that looks like.
Okay.
All right. Our time is evaporating. I think this is a logical stopping point. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we will have the Sue Porter, who does the forecasting for the prison population and the community corrections, will be in at first, and I guess then move on to community corrections. Seems like we're headed. All right. Thank you all for coming. We're going to continue over the hearing on Senate Bill 5509 until Wednesday, April 23rd, 2003, at 1 o'clock. And we are going to, at this point in time, close the public hearing for today.